Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison, and our speaker today is Ron Solomon, who is on the board of the American Ethical Union. Are you the treasurer of that?
Yes.
And also has recently become one of the vice presidents of the International Ethical and Humanist Union, and has begun going to meetings around the world. And the topic today is Humanist Thought and Action. Ron Solomon.
Well, thanks, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here. When Bob talked to me about coming this Sunday, I think perhaps it was a difference of thought that we didn't really work out in the communications. He had been talking to me since I moved here over a year ago about the possibility of establishing some kind of a study group or education group or discussion group, whatever you want to call it, that would be ongoing, and it could take any one of a number of forms. And some of the ideas Bob has mentioned to me is the thought about forming a more explicitly humanist congregation, I guess, than the Unitarian congregations that are here. He knows of my background in ethical culture. I've been a member of ethical societies for getting close to 50 years now, believe it or not. Started when I was 17. And so I've been really heavily involved in ethical societies and in ethical culture nationally. And I've, of course, have been to a variety of Unitarian congregations over a number of years, first in St. Louis, where I grew up and first joined the Ethical Society, and in Baltimore, and in my travels as well. And I've been to one or two programs here. Haven't been to the other Unitarian congregations in Madison yet, but expect to get to them one of these days. Those of you who know about ethical culture know that there's a lot of similarities, but also some differences. And so I thought, just as a brief introduction, I'd talk about the fact that it seems to me there are really two basic kinds of groups that share this common philosophy that we call by a whole lot of different names, whether we call it humanism, our ethical culture, our atheism, our free thought, or rationalism. It has a whole bunch of different names, both in this country and around the world. But it seems to me there's two fundamentally different types of organizations that are involved in this movement, for want of a better term, I guess I'll use. One of those kinds of organizations is represented by the UUA and ethical culture in the United States particularly, and there are a few other groups like this in the world, but very few. And those groups are really congregationally oriented. Their focus is on being a community of people with shared values. And you all are obviously familiar with that because I think you're all members of either this Unitarian congregation or one of the Unitarian congregations here. And those of us who've been members of ethical societies, it's the same thing. You know, our congregations are very similar. There's a, you know, slight difference in emphasis, in focus. Some of us have thought that Unitarian Universalism in a larger context has like a broader range of diversity in it, perhaps, than ethical culture. But I've been in some Unitarian congregations that you could really never distinguish between being in an ethical culture society or in a Unitarian congregation other than by the name on the sign. So there's some very great similarities. In ethical culture, we like to say that ethics is our religion. And we had a Unitarian minister who both has been a congregational leader and has been involved at the national level in congregational growth for the Unitarians, and we had hired him as a consultant to help us with growth. And one of the things that people commonly ask is, what's the difference between ethical culture and Unitarian Universalism? And he said, I think there's a fundamental difference in focus, and I would sum it up by saying that Unitarians often focus on, how do I know what to believe? And ethical culture people focus more on, how do I know how to act? But even within that distinction, the commonalities are so great that it's really hard to pin down sometimes what the differences are. Obviously, the organizations are separate and different. There have been times in the past where they've cooperated in various things, offices in Washington and at the UN. Then there have been other times when the cooperation hasn't been so great. I'm sure those of you who've paid any attention to the national leadership of the UUA have known over the years that sometimes it has a little more of a humanist focus and sometimes a little less of a humanist focus. And so maybe for some of you that's troubling. Maybe that's why you joined this humanist group, because you felt that somehow there's something a little bit lacking in the focus of Unitarianism, even though I'm sure you're all comfortable in the congregation as well. On the international scene, as Bob mentioned, there is this coalition that was formed over 50 years ago called the International Humanist and Ethical Union. And it has member organizations on 6 continents. It has well over 100 groups. Some of them are quite small. Many of them are pretty large. And it has only a very few, as I say, that are congregationally or community-oriented like we are. The vast bulk of organizations are really focused more around the idea of humanism, or whatever they happen to call it. Some of them are atheist organizations, some of them are called rationalist organizations, and so forth. But they seem more organized around the principle that their biggest goal is to provide an organization for people who share a common set of values, but who are really interested in trying to publicize and spread that set of values and make more people in the world aware of it. You probably know that even though the United States shows up on most surveys as being the most, quote, religious country in the world, based on how people answer questions about how often they attend church and whether they consider themselves religious or not, the reality is that there are some huge number of people here that clearly do not identify with what we typically used to call the traditional religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and so forth. But recently, I've been present when somebody was strongly corrected for reusing the term traditional religions. Because there's another congregational group in the United States called the Society for Humanistic Judaism. And those are people who are very closely identified with what they consider the cultural and ethnic heritage of Judaism, but not the religion. I mean, their religion is humanism. And they take offense at the idea that, you know, they're not part of traditional religions. So I have to find a new term, because, you know, we don't want to offend them either. There's a newly formed group in the United States, another coalition called the Secular Coalition for America. It has, I think, 8 or 9 member organizations now. The American Ethical Union is one of them, the denominational body of ethical culture. And the Society for Humanistic Judaism is another. And there are some atheist groups and there are some humanist groups like the American Humanist Association. Now, they are formed for a very specific purpose, and that is lobbying and making our elected officials in Washington aware that in the United States, we have this strong constitutional principle about the separation of church and state, and yet it is eroded and under attack in many, many places and in many, many different forms. And so groups got together and said, how can we make a difference, you know, in combating that? And so that's how this coalition came into being. They have had a full-time lobbyist, and now they have two part-time lobbyists as well. They haven't been around for very long, but they've been really successful in doing what they're doing. Somebody had this brilliant idea of trying to find the highest elected official who would come out of a closet as a non-believer. And they actually found over 20 congresspeople, but only one who would say it publicly. And that is Congressman Pete Stark from California. They announced it last winter. He is the highest elected official in the United States who has come forth and said, I am a non-believer. I am not a theist. I don't believe in the traditional concepts of God or in any of the traditional religious views. So there are, of course, many officials on a state and local level, perhaps, that are non-believers as well. So the secular coalition, somebody at that coalition knows who these other 20-some members of Congress are, but nobody else does because they are not going to spill the beans. And the people who are our lobbyists don't know because, as the senior lobbyist said, she said, I don't want to ever be in a position where somebody says to me, is so-and-so one of those 20 people, and I might just by some involuntary facial expression give away whether that person is or isn't. So I don't want to know. So I thought that was a really, really clever thought that she had to do that. I think that what I hoped today was going to be was really more of a discussion. I could talk to you about some of the other organizations in the United States if you want. I brought some materials, pamphlets and books and things that could serve as the basis for discussions in the future if we would like to have those. And so really, I'm more interested in what you all would like to do, if anything. Well, and maybe there's nothing, so I don't know.
Since you mentioned the Secular Coalition for America, Laurie Littman Brown was one of the speakers in the past.
Oh, okay.
In fact, her father, Mel Littman, was here for the same occasion. It was when she was in town for the Freedom from Religion annual.
Right, last October,
so
I guess.
You must know Laurie.
Yeah, well, she's the senior lobbyist, right? Mm-hmm. She's the one that I just more paraphrased what she said about not wanting to know who the other 20-some members of Congress are.
I was just going to mention that you and Mel Littman were at the same time elected as vice president of the International.
Right. And Mel is currently the president of the American Humanist Association.
Right. Which we're affiliated with.
You know, I would rather hear a little more about the actual differences between the Ethical Society and perhaps the Humanists and the Unitarians, a little bit more of the content. The organization, okay, we can always deal with that, but the content is what I would be interested in.
Well, that would be, I think, one of the things that if we had a discussion group, we could explore at some depth, because it's in a lot of ways it's very subtle. As I said, fundamentally, The first difference is the way the groups are organized. And so even the American Humanist Association, which has, I think, over 50 or 100 chapters in the United States now, they're organized very differently. They didn't organize as congregations or communities. They organized primarily as people who identified with the values of humanism. And then they said, well, we share this value. Why can't we find ways to be more communitarian as a group? And so they're struggling in a lot of ways to get to where the Unitarians and ethical culture started, because we started as congregations. We didn't start as organizations that focused on an idea so much.
Yeah. What do you do about your children's education? We'll call it religious education, but
well,
this
we
is
call,
so important.
We call it religious education and ethical culture because we make no bones about the fact that we are a religion, okay, but our religion is ethics.
So you would
and
use
so,
a similar curriculum.
Right. So our ethical societies have Sunday schools for children. We are in the midst of developing a lot of materials for homeschooling and for individual schooling, because many people have asked for materials that they can use to help provide moral guidance to their children and ethical guidance, but they haven't been able to find it, and they might live in a place where there is no ethical society.
It seems like an area in which cooperation would be very helpful on both sides.
There has been
the same materials could be used, and we should have access to them.
Well, there is. In fact, there's been a tremendous amount of cooperation in that area. And when I mentioned before that there had been some, like in the office in Washington and at the UN, I neglected to mention that, so thanks for pointing that out. There have been, over the years, several people who have been the director of religious education first for the UUA and then for ethical culture, or vice versa.
So
there's been a lot of cross-fertilization there. And even at the local level, I'm aware of many people who have been religious education directors at local congregations of both flavors, sometimes at the same time, you know, because they're part-time. No, there is no ethical congregation here. There's a monthly ethical discussion group here.
Led by your son?
Organized and led by my original. Well, I don't know if anybody leads it anymore, but he organized it and got it going.
You aren't providing for religious education in that situation.
No.
Right.
In fact, there is no ethical culture society anywhere in Wisconsin.
Right, the closest one's in Chicago.
So ethical culture, the word ethical is an umbrella concept. The ethics that you subscribe to are the ethics of humanism, then?
Yes.
I mean, that's...
Right.
This may be
nitpicking,
but if you just say ethical...
To make it very simple. I mean, one of the things I thought we could propose for a discussion group, if people are interested in that... We have something called the 8 Commitments of Ethical Culture. We like to say we're a religion without creed, just like I think the Unitarians like to say that they're also a religion without creed. But we all know that even that is sort of a shorthand way of saying something that's not 100% true, because we do share a common set of beliefs, and while we don't have like things carved on stone tablets that we all have to believe, or you know, prayers that we say and things like that, you know, there are certain fundamental principles that we do in fact subscribe to, and the ones that if you looked at, you know, what the fundamental precepts of Unitarian Universalism are, you probably wouldn't find much difference between what the fundamental, say, the 8 commitments of ethical culture are.
Yeah, somebody
but we could have a discussion about that. In fact, when my son formed this discussion group 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, I'm not sure when, before we moved here, he contacted the AEU and said, you know, if we formed a group, what materials could we use? And they gave him a few choices of different things that could be used, and they focused first on those 8 commitments. And for the first 8 months that they met, each meeting was on one of the 8 commitments. They read what the commitment was, and then they had a discussion about it. And so that's something we could do. I think, you know, people might find that interesting. We have a pamphlet on building ethical communities. That's another thing, you know, we could read. It's pretty short, maybe 15 or 20 pages, and we could have a discussion about that. We could get into a more in-depth philosophical discussion if people are really interested in exploring the differences in what these groups see as how they define their particular flavor of whatever they call it. The International Humanist and Ethical Union has had struggled for a significant number of years with trying to decide how to describe what they thought humanism was. And they finally came up with the term life stance. They didn't like the term religion. One of the reasons we've found in being active in the IHEU is that the Europeans in particular have come from countries where religious oppression by a state religion has been severe. And so they have a more problematic attitude about words like religion. They don't see it in as broad a context as I think we do. And so they came up with this word life stance. But, you know, to me it's the same thing. I mean, I could call ethical culture a life stance or a religion.
The Americans are sensitized to the fact that fellow citizens like the idea that we have a religion. I mean, I'm on a school board. I don't have any trouble defining myself as a humanist, but if I said I didn't have a religion, that would be... lose some credibility, and I think many of us are in that spot.
This is a long tradition. I've done research on an Austrian who wrote articles from here back to Europe and also in this country. And around, he was sort of a 19th century Charles Couvalt. He wrote throughout the country and drew lovely pictures and then described what was going on in this new world, quote unquote. And in one instance, he was talking about the churches, and he made the statement about 1855 or so that in this country it seems to be very important that you have a religion. It doesn't matter exactly which religion, but it's very important that you have one. Now, this was a statement when there were few people in this.
1855.
Yes. I have it right.
We haven't changed a bit.
Not
a bit. Well, they were like that already, because James Monroe, our fourth president, was pretty close to coming out as an atheist.
Yeah. I think there's
go ahead. Sorry, I don't know
things,
everybody.
Two things I want to address. One is the fact that ethical culture has declared itself a religion, and in some respects, the humanist groups have as well. And then because if humanists, the rationale is if humanists or secular humanists, as it's used a number of times, you know, if they believe in evolution, for example, evolution's being taught in schools, humanism is a religion, therefore they're interfering with what's being taught in public school. I mean, that's kind of some of the rationale that's being used to get creationism.
Against it.
Is if they can teach, if,
so they can teach creationism.
So they can teach creationism. And that goes way before even the creationist argument. I mean, that's been used for a long time.
That's been a very strong rallying cry of the Christian conservative movement in this country for over 30 years, mm-hmm. I think, is that they say that there is a religion being taught in the public schools, and that religion is humanism or secular humanism.
Yes.
And so they feel like they're just arguing for equal time for their version of the truth. Right?
The truth. Yeah.
And I don't know if this is what you were going to say, in the 1950s, there was a case that went to the Supreme Court that the American Ethical Union was involved in, and the American Civil Liberties Union. A young man who had filed with his draft board to be a conscientious objector, but did not believe in a supreme being. He had grown up in ethical culture. And in those days, every draft board denied any conscientious objector application if you didn't come from, like, the Quakers, for example. They recognized Quakers. They said, okay, we know you're pacifists. We'll let you opt out as conscientious objectors. But they wouldn't let non-theists. This case went all the way to Supreme Court. Supreme Court upheld the fact that this young man could be a conscientious objector and not serve in the military, be excused from military service. But in the opinion that they wrote, they actually used the term the religion of secular humanism.
Yes.
And so it's actually enshrined in a Supreme Court decision.
What was the split on the Supreme Court?
I don't remember what. I knew once what the vote was. I don't remember. I don't remember how close it was.
I wondered whether the ethical culture had been recognized in the courts as a non-theistic religion.
Ethical culture has had a couple or three very interesting religious court battles over the years. One was about 10 years ago in Illinois with the Chicago Ethical, what they call themselves the Ethical Humanist Society of Chicago, by the way. I would say several of our societies call themselves Ethical Humanist Societies. We're not big on having a creed about what our names are. So we have ethical culture societies, we have ethical societies.
Societies for the culture.
Societies for ethical culture, ethical human societies. one of them was in Illinois about 10 years ago. And most recently was in Austin, Texas. Now, most of us think of Texas as the Bible Belt, and it is. But we've had an ethical society there now for not too many years, maybe a dozen or so, and it was a small group. Austin is a very cosmopolitan city. Of course, it's like Madison in some respects. It's a state capital and the home of the major campus of the state university. So it's got a lot of influences that you might not find in a lot of other areas of Texas, let's say. So the Austin Society had been there. It had been incorporated as an ethical society, as a religious organization. And somebody realized that when they were buying supplies for their services, like coffee and paper plates and whatever else they bought, they were paying sales tax. And it's like, well, we should have a sales tax exemption, right? So they filled out a form and sent it into the state, I think it was the comptroller's office, to get the sales tax exemption. And they got the sales tax exemption.
They had a bulk permit, too, didn't they?
What?
Didn't they have a bulk permit as a...
They probably had a bulk permit. I mean, they were incorporated as a religious organization. Right. There was no question about it. They had never had any issues whatsoever. They got the sales tax exemption. And then about 2 weeks later, or so, they got a letter from the comptroller's office revoking their sales tax exemption. So they wrote back and they found out ultimately that what happened was the guy who was the comptroller of Texas was a fundamentalist Christian. He was planning to run for governor, and he had decided politically it was feasible to take a stand against these godless atheist communist pinko wacko liberals. And so basically he was quoted in the newspaper as saying something like that: no godless atheist communist group is ever going to get a religious tax exemption while I'm comptroller of this state. I mean, that was pretty much what he said. So they had to fight it. They found legal support from all over the state of Texas. The ACLU got involved. They got law professors from various universities, even places that you would really think of as the Bible Belt, like Texas Tech University in Lubbock. They had one of their principal lawyers was from there. And they fought it, and they fought it, and it went all the way to the Texas Supreme Court, but they won. They prevailed.
What happened to the political aspirations of the...
You know, I don't know. I haven't ever even asked them whether that person, you know, has run for higher office and gotten elected, whether he's still comptroller or what.
You don't know what his name was telling us something.
He became a woman and became the governor of Alaska.
Oh, that's it. Maybe that's why we don't know. Went under a sex change operation.
Anyway, that there should be no religious tax exemptions. And that would solve the problem.
Well, there are certainly a lot of people who believe that.
There's a lot of property owned by the Catholic Church specifically that is not on the tax rolls and costing us all.
You bring up it's a very interesting point, though. And a lot of turmoil within the people who are members, you know, whether they should be tax free. I mean, they're a non-profit, that's for sure. They're, you know, so they're, in that sense, they fit in. And, you know, if other non-profits are going to be given these rights, then, you know, but I mean, at the Ethical Society in Baltimore and also in St. Louis, there was a lot of argument over whether we should even be called a religion. Yeah. You know, just different people, you know, what's a righteous person? Do you have to be Christian to be righteous? You know,
you might be called officers.
The Ethical Culture Society has its roots in Judaism, and does that have any continuing significance?
I don't think so. I know that some people say that Unitarianism is the Christian version of ethical culture, or some people say that ethical culture is the Jewish version of Unitarianism. So, you know, you can look at it from either side. It's sort of like looking at a glass and trying to figure out if it's half full or half empty. Obviously, the man who first founded ethical culture, Felix Adler, his father was a rabbi in the largest liberal congregation of New York City, Temple Emmanuel. Young Felix was presumed that he would become a rabbi and succeed his father at the pulpit of Temple Emmanuel. He was educated first in New York, and then he went to Germany to study. His ethical development, though, beyond Judaism itself, which is a very strong ethics-based religion. I mean, there's a very strong core of ethics in Judaism. But when he was in Germany, he also got really familiar with the ideas of Immanuel Kant and of people who succeeded Kant called the Neo-Kantians. And Kant was definitely not Jewish. He was, in fact, Christian, and one of Kant's struggles was trying to come up with some sort of universal principles of ethics, but still fit it into a Christian context. So Adler had, like, this Jewish ethics background, and he had this Kantian ethics background, which came out of Christianity as well. Wouldn't say necessarily came out of Christianity, but it tried to wrap itself around or include Christianity in it. So he was struggling with all those things. He came back to the United States, and what he really thought was that at their core, all religions share the same fundamental values, and that it's only when they talk about their metaphysics, about what they think about God and who God is or what God is and, you know, what their religious texts are and certain practices that have been handed down for centuries or millennia or whatever, that's where they differ. And so he thought that really the religion of the future was a religion that focused on what that common core is. And he saw it as ethics and relationships and how people relate to each other and relate to the world. And so he said that, you know, we should create a religion that doesn't really talk about what you believe in terms of after you die or what's out there. Is there a heaven? Is there not a heaven? Is there a hell? Is there not a hell? Is there a God? Is there not a God? That's not important. What's important is, what are you doing here? What are you doing now? And that's why ethical culture, as I say, has evolved more into this idea that for us the fundamental question is how do I know how to act? Because we're talking about acting in this world, in this life.
With regard to that, and you talk about acting in terms of how we act with each other, but also how we act in the world. And I don't want to interrupt your train of thought, but if you could approach what some of the humanitarian roles have been for ethical culture people in terms of dealing with the greater society.
Well, from the very beginning, I mean, as I say, that was really a core concept and a core organizing principle when the Ethical Society started. And in those days, almost all social services, all charitable work were provided through religious organizations. And in most cases, they came with a dose of proselytizing. And it's true to this day for a lot of things that are provided by a lot of really good organizations, but there's a message that comes along with it, and some of us don't find those messages very palatable. In any case, so they were the Ethical Society in New York, the first society, was instrumental in the founding of an incredible number of organizations which have survived to this day. They're not connected with ethical culture, but they are things that we're all very familiar with, like the ACLU, like the NAACP. They founded the first organization that became what's now called the Visiting Nurse Association. They were the first people to have the idea of nurses that would actually go to people. They were... The settlement house movement had just started in the United States. There was a settlement house in New York and one in Chicago. You all heard of
Jane.
Yeah. She affiliated with the Ethical Society in Chicago. Mm-hmm. The next person who became what we call a leader in the ethical culture, which is the equivalent of a minister, a trained person, John Lovejoy Elliott. He was the next one who was the first one who was trained by Felix Adler to become a leader as well. He lived for a number of years at the Settlement House in Chelsea in New York City, mm-hmm. and worked with the folks there. So those things have been there. And in more recent times, at a national level, I would say a lot of what the American Ethical Union has focused on more is maintaining a presence and a relationship with the United Nations. And so has the International Humanist and Ethical Union. And there's a group of people who represent the AHA, the AEU, the International Humanist and Ethical Union, and one or two other groups in New York at the UN, and they've formed a organization called the Council of Ethics-Based Organizations. And they're, all these people, all these groups have been recognized as non-governmental organizations by the UN so that they can have representatives participate in the non-governmental work of the UN, which is really where most of the work of the UN is actually done throughout the world. And so they're very active at that level. And then, of course, local ethical societies, much like local Unitarian congregations, do all manner of things in their local or state communities, depending on what their members are really interested in being involved in. And in some societies, there's like a huge involvement in the effort to get single-payer health care, for example. In others, they're working with delivering food, to people, or whether it's needy poor people or needy like a AIDS population, HIV population, for example. So there's all those things going on as well.
There's something very interesting at the UUA General Assembly this past year when the Washington Ethical Society was welcomed as a new Unitarian Universalist congregation while maintaining its affiliation with the American Ethical Union. So they became a dual affiliate.
Talk about an uproar.
What sort of uproar?
And that started a rumor about is there a merger in the works between ethical culture and UUA?
Well,
you as an insider heard anything about this?
Well, I actually heard talk about a merger. It was, I'm going to say it was probably 30 or 35 years ago in the 1970s. There actually were discussions that were carried on more or less in secret between the president, then president of the American Ethical Union, and the then president of the UUA. But they fell through.
Rumors have come roaring up again.
Well, it took 100 years or more for the Unitarians and Universalists to get together. So probably wouldn't be surprising that it took a while.
Right.
If it ever happens.
I would say this. There are no active thoughts about mergers that I know of. You know, Bob brings up reference to what the Washington Ethical Society did. It was very interesting evolution of this process, I guess. The Washington Society had a significant number, not a huge number, but a significant number of members that had decided that the American Ethical Union and ethical culture, because of its smallness and its lack of significant resources, I guess, didn't provide some of the services that they needed as well as the Unitarians did. And they got a lot of services from the UUA. They got curriculum materials sometimes that they, when they thought that the materials we had weren't satisfactory and so on. So at some point, some of them thought that maybe they'd be better off being a Unitarian congregation. So they actually started talking about leaving the ethical culture movement and joining the UUAs. Well, it turned out they weren't like a huge number of people there, but they were some of them were pretty influential there. So ultimately, they decided to have some town meetings of, you know, invite all the congregation in, and they have a congregation of well over 300 members. Not huge like, say, the First Unitarian Society here, but they're pretty big. They're pretty big, pretty significant, pretty substantial group. And talk about their options. Well, they identified six options that people were interested in, and they formed study groups around each of these options. And one of the options was dual affiliation. And as far as I know, the person who came up with this idea said, you know, some of the ethical societies have become affiliated with the American Humanist Association as humanist chapters. A handful of them, in fact. Chicago has, Baltimore, where I was, has, North Carolina, and a few others. So they said, well, you know, we don't really think about affiliating with the American Humanist Association, but maybe we'd like to dual affiliate with the Unitarian Universalists as well as ethical culture. So that was one of these six groups. And ultimately, through a whole bunch of meetings and a long, drawn-out process, that was the path they chose. There were some people in other ethical societies who really were in an uproar about this. They thought this was like the worst thing that could possibly happen. Some of us thought it was kind of interesting and, you know, would like to see what it develops. That was my position, basically. Anyway, there were lots of discussions, and there were some people who really thought that we should not allow them to do that and so on, but there were others who thought, you know, let them try it out and see what happens. Maybe they'll come up with a new model of something that'll work for congregations all over. Maybe ultimately it will lead to a a merger that instead of coming from the top down, comes from the bottom up, you know, where the groups actually realize that we all have so much in common that maybe we ought to be the same. But
well, along these lines, we visited the Minneapolis. There's two churches in Minneapolis. One is a Universalist church, which is quite traditional, and the other is a, if it, for all intents and purposes, an ethical culture church.
I've been there.
It's called Unitarian. Have you been there?
First Unitarian Society, and, I think, yeah.
And so what? How did they get into that position?
Well, I don't know how they got in that position, but I can tell you a couple things that I do know. For one thing, in the upper Midwest, there is a very strong humanist tradition here. And a lot of it, I think, goes back to the immigrants who came from Scandinavia. But not exclusively, but a lot of it does. And by the way, Norway, the Norwegian Ethical Humanist Society is one of the largest and strongest members of the International Humanist and Ethical Union. And they have, I think Norway is right up there with the Netherlands. Those are the two countries that have the most identified members of humanist organizations of any countries in the world. And of course, neither of those countries has huge populations, but they have a huge number of identified members. A variety of reasons for that, which you don't need to go into. But they do have a strong humanist tradition. And so I think my sense is that a lot of the Unitarian groups in the upper Midwest have been more strongly aligned with humanist thought than some other Unitarian groups. But not exclusively. I've been to the First Unitarian Church in San Diego. Huge place, beautiful place. Oh my gosh, you would love it. If you ever get a chance to go there, go there. Very humanist congregation, very, very humanist. And San Diego, of course, as you know, is a pretty conservative city, you know, very strong military population and so on. But this congregation is huge. It's at least as big as the one here, and maybe bigger. I don't know. And just fantastic place. So I think that's one part of it. The person who was the minister at that First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis was first an ethical culture leader, Corin Arisian.
What was that?
Corin Arisian was his name. And I've known him for quite a while, and we were there when they had a retirement party for him when he retired as minister of that congregation. And then after a few years in retirement, he came out of retirement for a short time, like 4 or 5 years, to be the leader again of the New York Ethical Society. And he's just like 2 or 3 years ago retired for a second time. But he's in his 70s now. So.
Why don't you say a word about what ethical culture has instead of ministers and sermons in your Sunday morning meetings? You don't have so-called ministers, you have...
Well, we have leaders, as we call them, but they're the functional equivalent of a minister, and they're professionally trained. You know, we have a training program, a seminary, so to speak, but we don't have a physical seminary, so it's a seminary without walls where we train them. And there's a lot of cross-training that goes on, too. There's an organization called the Humanist Institute, which was formed about 20 or 25 years ago to train humanist leaders of all the different groups.
Is that the one in Albany?
Hmm?
Is that the one in Albany?
No, that's the Institute for Humanist Studies.
Oh, okay.
It gets very confusing. We could spend a whole day talking about all these different groups.
Is that the one that Sarah Olberg was telling us
about? Yeah, Sarah Olberg went to the Humanist Institute.
Oh, okay.
She's a graduate.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. I know the name. I think I've only met her once. I probably wouldn't recognize her if I ran into her again, but I do know the name. So that group's been around, and part of most ethical culture leaders' training when they're going in our seminary is to attend the Humanist Institute courses as well and participate in that, which all, that also is a seminary without walls. The Institute for Humanist Studies is a more recent phenomenon, and it's more tapping into the new age of the internet. And so they're providing a lot of training materials and educational materials and coursework, actually, that, again, if we want to take part of it, we could use some of their materials as a focus for a discussion group. And there are things that people can do just on their own as well. I mean, anybody who's interested. And I can provide you with references to all this kind of material if you like.
Excellent. Instead of sermons, you have platform addresses.
We call them platform addresses in ethical culture rather than sermons.
Are they functionally similar?
They're functionally similar. Each society is a little different in how they do it. Some have traditionally had a lot more focus on music and trying to provide at least partially an intergenerational experience where they have the children in at the beginning of the meeting for a while to participate in some part of it before they go off to the Sunday school part. But yeah, again, like we said, if you walked into the First Unitarian in Minneapolis or the Washington Ethical Society, you might not know that you were in a different place.
You immediately get the idea that the word God is not acceptable in Minneapolis, but that's okay.
Definitely one of the reasons why we go to ethical societies. We don't want to be bombarded with any kind of...
With that
right. Yeah. We don't really care.
Emphasis on that.
We don't really care what people believe about God. We just don't want to hear about it. We don't want to talk about it.
Do you do music?
Depends on the society.
Most societies do music. Carol was our regular singer in Baltimore for years and years and years.
Now, so much of the music does come from a Christian tradition.
No, I didn't use any Christian tradition. Well,
I mean, music by Bach.
It's a gift to be simple.
There's one hymn in the Unitarian Universalist hymnal by Felix Adler, which we happened to sing this morning.
Because I picked it.
Very good.
Did he write it for everyone? I don't know. I mostly folk music, so.
We have had very little of the more organized hymn kind of singing in ethical culture than I know some Unitarian congregations do. But several of our societies have formed choruses, and so among other choral works that they find that they like to sing, some of them are these kind of non-secular or non-theistic hymns, like from some of the Unitarian materials. And there's a songbook that Ethical Culture had published about 50 or 60 years ago that has a bunch of songs in it that are mostly pretty hymnal.
They're very Unitarian-ish.
I was going to say, I have one, the Ethical.
Their eyes up to me.
Yeah.
Whatever it's called.
We sing of life. We sing of life. Most of them are crossovers between the current and Unitarian.
Right. Well, they've been trying for years and years to come up with a different songbook. But every society has its own kind of a slant on it, so it makes it really hard, you know, for them to agree on what music. And they're really individuals. Each society is distinct, although very similar. So, you know, it's hard to come to agreement.
Are you a leader yourself?
No.
No.
Take a look at the Prairie Songbook. There's probably more Pete Seeger than Bach in it, but it's also popular, so we have to make more copies every once in a while because they vanish.
We had that problem with
our... On the other hand, our hymnal, the big book, is full of traditional Lutheran hymns, and it's a matter of music, and you can always change words, but I see no sense of throwing out the music. This is a very important cultural possession we have.
Music. But I know that most ethical society people don't like hymn-like sounds. Mm-hmm. They don't like that I mean, you can tell. You can just tell right away. It's very Lutheran.
Have we thought about making common cause with Confucianism? We probably wouldn't even have to worship their ancestors. We might be able to worship our own.
It's kind of hard for ethical culture people to worship anybody.
That term has had some problems with religion.
I wanted to mention that. I think it's the Institute for Humanist Studies, the one that's more the online. I was there recently, maybe it's about 6 weeks ago, and they have a statement on their website saying that due to a donation from a member, all their courses are free for a certain amount of time. So I just wanted to share that.
Wow.
I mean, they were never expensive. I don't know, $20, $30 or whatever, but I just want to mention that. Now's the time to go in. Yeah. I know their courses
up here. Also, in connection with the Institute for Humanist Studies, they sponsor the Humanist Network News, which has a monthly podcast. And starting tomorrow, Monday, our program on WIDELP Humanism Today will be alternating programs recorded here at Humanist Union of Madison and podcasts from the Humanist Network News. Mm-hmm. And tomorrow we'll play the podcast where they interview Andy Rooney, where he mentions that he is an atheist.
I thought I'd pass around. This is the pamphlet I referred to, Creating Ethical Community. And I think I could get many more copies of it, and that's one thing we could use for a discussion. These are three books if people are interested more in like more substantial things to discuss, you know, but in more depth.
Since this is being broadcast,
but even that has a lot of meat in it, and I know from the number of times I've been in Unitarian congregations that one of the values we do share in common, ethical culture and Unitarians, is that we all like to talk a lot. So so you know we can take like,
eat and talk.
Eat too, yeah. We used to say the Baltimore Ethical Society. The initials are BES. We used to say it stands for the Baltimore Eating Society. So you could take a quick look at these and see if there's interest. These also are a short pamphlet. I actually have a whole bunch of these, so you're welcome to take one or more if you would like.
Pass it the other way. So
you don't have to pass them all around.
Pat just made a good suggestion about the books. Why don't you come in here?
Well, we're passing the books around. You might mention the names of the books since it's being broadcast on the...
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I guess I'll start chronologically with the newest one first, even though this one has no official connection to any humanist organization. This book is called Practical Ethics by Peter Singer. He's a professor of ethics at Princeton.
That's the same Peter Singer that's written about animals?
Yes. In fact, it, one of the most provocative parts of this book that when people have discussions about it is his views on animals' rights as well as humans' rights. So that's Practical Ethics by Peter Singer. Then a little older is a book written by Edward Erickson, who is both a retired ethical culture leader and a retired Unitarian minister, called The Humanist Way, An Introduction to Ethical Humanist Religion. And last, a book that's about 50 or 60 years old, so it's some of the language in particular is a little dated, but I still find it to be a very, very useful book. Is called Ethics as a Religion by David Saville Muzzy, who was an ethical culture leader back in the, 30s and 40s, and also a professor of philosophy and religion at Columbia University.
Sounds very interesting.
So those are the three books. The small pamphlet that I passed around is called Creating Ethical Community, Faith and Human Worth, and it was primarily written by the leader and members of the Washington Ethical Society about 15 or 20 years ago. And then there's a pamphlet that I'm letting everybody have as many copies as they want, because I have a lot of them. It's called A Concept Map for Ethical Culture Towards Philosophical Consensus. This was a joint philosophical statement that our leaders collectively developed. And our leaders don't do anything collectively unless they have consensus on it, unanimity of consensus, not just partial consensus. So as you can imagine,
so it's just a little bitty
if you can imagine if we as members like to talk a lot, leaders like ministers like to talk even more. And so you can just imagine if you had been a fly on the wall, that you could have probably heard a deep philosophical discussion about virtually every word in this, whatever, 23-page book. And the last thing I'll pass around, also you can take, just so you have it and know what it is, it's this group I mentioned called, this new group called the Secular Coalition for America. It's their pamphlet, and as Bob said, you've had Lori Lipman Brown out here, so maybe you've already seen this pamphlet or have one, but in case you did or don't, or want another one, there it is.
Thank you very much.